It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Well, good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I know Kirk made fun of me last week.
No, I didn't make fun of you.
I'm here to defend myself.
No. I just commented on the fact that of the two people that are part of the show, there was only one present.
That's right.
In front of the microphone, you had a much needed convalescence.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, we'll go with that.
All right. So welcome back, Casey.
Welcome back, Kirk. And Kirk, we're going to talk a little about Everclear this morning. Probably not an ideal topic for a Saturday morning. And if our listeners don't understand what Everclear is, it's a 180 proof, yes, liquor, I believe. No, 190 proof liquor. 95% yeah. Alcohol by volume.
Right.
Basically just
pretty
straight
nasty.
Alcohol.
Yeah.
Just straight alcohol.
It has no flavor.
And it has no flavor. And
messes you up bad.
Right. It's commonly mixed with Red Bull, Gatorade, or fruit juice.
That's where you get the flavor from.
I've had this in my college days. Have you had this
no,
before?
No, I've never actually tried
it's just,
it. But
it's horrible.
I've heard bad things happen when people drink this. I know
yes,
that much.
That's right. And they want to now ban it in the state of Wisconsin. It's unclear whether this is going to pass, but right now it's sold at, you know, liquor stores and grocery stores,
sure,
and places like that. It's perfectly legal.
Do you happen to know if it's banned anywhere else in the country?
It is banned in 15 other states have similar laws banning it. So that would be, if I do the math, 35 states that do not ban it.
Right.
Including Wisconsin. Did you like that quick math?
That was quick.
That was very quick. For a lawyer. Right?
No calculator
involved. But
he did use an abacus.
They want to ban the sale, consumption, and possession of this liquor. And it could be a felony for selling it. You could be fined up to $10,000 or imprisoned for up to 3.5 years just for selling it. Now, possessing it would carry a fine of anywhere between $200 and $5,000. Now, the impetus for this, the purpose behind this, at least as stated by some of the legislators, is that this would prevent sexual assaults from occurring.
I had no idea you were going there.
Because
I was going to say it would prevent people from
binge drinking
or protecting people from a very dangerous substance.
Well, and here's the problem I have with this, though. I mean, first of all, if somebody's going to commit a sexual assault and get intoxicated to the point where they don't remember something, couldn't they just as easily do that with other liquors? I mean, yeah, okay, it takes a lesser amount of this particular liquor to do it.
Right.
But I've never understood.
So that's twice the 80 proof, so just, you know,
exactly,
two drinks instead of one.
That would be a good, that's another good
math. Or four drinks instead of two.
That's right.
See, I can do it too.
You could do it. Much better than I could. So, you know, in terms of this, I don't know that this seems to me to be the same idea as prohibition, right? I mean, we're going to solve all the problems by just banning it, by just banning the substance. And as you point out, there are other substances that they could that people could use if they want to get highly intoxicated.
Well, you know, there's something that's, I don't know how long they've been selling Everclear, because I'm pretty sure that when I was younger, I didn't see it on the liquor shelves like you see it now. It's been around for a while, but, you know, I'm pretty old, so. But something that has been on the shelves for a very long time, at least as long as I can remember, is Bacardi 151.
Right.
And that's almost, well, it's 40 proof less, I guess, or 39 proof less. See? More math.
Good math.
You know, that's also a high alcohol beverage. And I don't know what the alcohol content is in a lot of these moonshines that you see for sale now.
Well, moonshine, is that even legal? Isn't
that illegal? They have stuff that they're calling moonshine.
Oh, they're calling moonshine. It's not actual
moonshine. Yeah, and they're saying that somebody in Kentucky made it, you know, whatever. And I was at the liquor store the other day, well, at the grocery store, walking by the liquor store, and I saw some sort of new moonshine product that's being marketed as, you know, White Lightning or whatever it is. And, you know, that's got, the whole point of that is that it's a high alcohol thing, too.
Well, and the same thing with Wapatuli or WAP. You've had WAP before, right?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You don't?
No.
Okay. So, you know, basically it's vodka mixed with a whole bunch of fruit, like actual fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And it just soaks up the vodka.
Oh, right.
And then when you drink it, it tastes like fruit juice, but you can't really tell that you're drinking
vodka.
Well,
that's just like a Long Island iced tea.
Right, exactly.
You know what's in a Long Island iced tea?
Lots of liquor.
Yeah, basically, what is it? Vodka,
five different
gin,
types of
rum, and whiskey, and Coke, I think. And for some reason, it tastes like an iced tea.
Right, and the point point is they're not going to ban that.
Right.
But yet they're saying they're going to ban this because typically you mix Everclear with things like, you know, Red Bull and Gatorade and other such fruit juices that make it not taste so, you know, alcoholic.
Purely alcoholic.
Right. And so this bill, I understand the intention behind the bill because we want to cut down on binge drinking, and we all do. I mean,
I just thought of something. We could ban Gatorade and Red Bull.
Well, that's what a great idea.
Because that way, you know, then that solves the problem.
Because I can tell you, nobody that I know can drink Everclear by itself.
Right.
It burns the throat too much.
Right.
Without that. So there you go. We could just ban that. No, but isn't the point of this whole discussion that when you talk about banning something, and we're going to get to Colorado legalizing the recreation.
Right. It's like kind of the opposite of this story.
Right.
You know?
Well, and we'll get to that in a moment because there are lots of doomsday predictions about what's going to happen in Colorado.
Right.
But when it comes to alcohol, and we've already learned the limits of prohibition, and the proponents of this will say, well, this is just high concentration alcohol. But it is kind of, and I know I use this analogy sometimes, but it is kind of like a slippery slope. Because once you get to 160 proof or higher, why not go lower than that? I mean, there are all kinds of vodkas, and as you point out, 151 and things like that could be banned. You could make the argument just as much that people get bombed on that. People drink beer to excess. And beer, we're never going to ban beer, or maybe some people might like to, but we're never going to do that. And so the point of this is, rather than, it's just like the drunk driving bills that look like they're not going to pass. A lot of people will say, and I believe Robin Boss, the Senate Majority Leader, said one of the reasons, and I happen to agree with him, by the way, that he doesn't think that they should go forward is because the money should instead go to drunk driving treatment courts and things like that, rather than just increasing the stiff penalties on drunk driving. You'll never believe I saw this thing I think it was in the Green Bay Press Gazette, talking about, well, if we really want to get serious about drunk driving, let's make first offense drunk driving a felony. That's what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I believe in Canada it is, basically.
Well, kind of. It is, but it's not.
They have more.
The thing, as we've said many times on this show, and I'll say it again in case you've never heard me spin my top on this issue, but the point is that in virtually every other jurisdiction that does treat drunk driving as a more serious offense than a non-criminal charge like we do, they have programs where the court system or a probation department or some kind of supervision process can intervene, and a person is given an opportunity to not have that drunk driving on their record. We don't do that here.
Right.
We don't have that at all.
Exactly.
And practically every other jurisdiction in our country and in Canada gives people an opportunity to basically work off a conviction by having a probationary license, by getting treatment, by attending AA, by having whatever requirements are set forth. And when a person successfully does those things, and we know that it reduces recidivism, you know, it's true that in New York, for example, a second offense drunk driving is a felony, but there are not a lot of people that get convicted of second offense drunk driving. And it's not because it's a felony. It's because treatment programs are put into place that give people an opportunity to not get convicted of it. And the only time you're really facing the actual consequences of a drunk driving conviction in most of those jurisdictions is when you fail out of the program and you don't do something that you should otherwise do. And you know what kind of makes sense about that is that no matter how hard we pound our fists as a society and how much we up the ante, I mean, you could make first offense drunk driving be eligible for the death penalty, and I'm not sure it's really going to reduce the amount of drunk driving because it's one of those offenses that, you know, it tends to be only after it happens or after it affects you personally or a family member or something like that where you take the obligation to not have enough alcohol in your system as seriously as you should. That combined with the fact, I mean, we all know it's not a good idea, yet it still happens all the time. But the problem is, as I've mentioned before, when someone's impaired by alcohol, they're not necessarily aware of their impairment. How many times have you been in a situation where somebody insisted that they were fine to drive and they felt perfectly fine,
right,
yet legally they weren't?
Yep.
And in terms of actual physical coordination and things like that, it was unsafe for that person to drive because the kind of impairment that the person has due to alcohol gives them an overly confident view of their own impairment.
Well, we've seen, and it just goes to show, we've seen people, this is not just your stereotypical, you know, middle-aged guy with a brown bag who's, you know, unemployed and is getting a bunch of drunk drivings. We've seen police officers get drunk driving, being charged with drunk driving.
Right.
We've seen, people who, you know, have never had a blemish on their record before. In fact, that's most people
right.
who end up getting a first offense drunk driving. So the point is, by just banning Everclear and banning these other substances, I'd like to see the stats on whether this actually works.
You haven't really given me a chance to chime in on the whole issue of Everclear, though.
Yeah, you go ahead.
I know, because we're going to get close to the break here, and I want to slip in my objection to your argument here.
Okay.
Because I do think that there's no real legitimate purpose for manufacturing a substance that is 190 proof. And if it is the dangerous thing. I mean, this is like selling dynamite in the store. And your argument would be, well, as long as people know how to use the dynamite correctly and they never light it, or they only light it a little bit or something like that. I mean, I can't think of any safe way that a human being can drink Everclear. So, and I think it's perfectly appropriate for our society to set some sort of limit
on something that is extremely dangerous. I've had it back in the day, and I'm fine.
Well,
I'm not dead.
Yeah, you're lucky. But, you know, I think that's part of the problem is that how much of a 190-proof beverage could anybody safely drink?
Oh, very little. And I had, I think, you know, half of a shot or something. I mean, it was not much. But people, you see what I'm saying? People could do that with any type of liquor. If they drink enough of it, it's unsafe.
Right, right. But this is almost like, you know, what's a good comparison? The only purpose behind this beverage, it doesn't taste like anything. It provides no intrinsic pleasure. It's not like you enjoy it
with cheese
and grapes or anything like that. No, I mean, its sole purpose is to get you as drunk as quickly as possible.
That's correct. And that may be immoral, but it's not illegal. It's legal to get drunk. Okay. It's certainly not legal to get drunk and drive a vehicle.
Right.
But it's legal to get drunk. Just get drunk by itself. All right. We have to take a break.
We'll be
right back in just a moment with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town. About to check outside the game. You know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Hey, Casey. Hi.
Hi, Kirk.
Are you high?
No, I'm not.
I bet they are in Colorado right now.
Very good. Well, legalized marijuana, recreational marijuana use in Colorado, at least for small amounts. You can buy
an ounce?
Up to an ounce.
That's not necessarily a small amount.
No, but if you're an out-of-state resident, I believe it's up to a quarter ounce.
Okay.
So they cut that down quite a bit. But recreational marijuana, and although certain types of marijuana use are legal in other states, Colorado becomes the first state to legalize the recreational use of marijuana without medical marijuana. And so this went into effect this past week on January 1st, and the city did not allow for any public celebrations about this whole thing because under Colorado's law, it happens to be unlawful to smoke marijuana in public, even though it's legal for recreational use. Really, the only safe place you can use it is within the confines of your own home.
Well, is it that different from... Most cities have an ordinance where you can't consume alcoholic beverages
in public,
outdoors.
Right.
You got to be in a tavern or something like that, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And I know that you can't smoke on the ski slopes. I've heard that.
That's true. You cannot smoke on the ski slopes. And so there's lots of buzz around this, pardon the pun. But the reason is because even former Representative Patrick Kennedy has said that these stores that are selling the marijuana are canaries in the coal mine. And he predicts, more traffic accidents, increased school truancy, higher dropout rates, and a decrease in public health.
Why?
I don't know. He's saying that's what marijuana is.
I seriously doubt, and I would, you know, there's going to be some statistical manipulation going on in the very near future. I guarantee it. I guarantee someone's going to put together some sort of analysis of how these things have gone on the increase. And it's just how you count your beans. That's how it works.
Isn't that 51% of statistics are made up? Isn't that the
phrase? Something like that. No, I think it was Mark Twain that said there's three kinds of lies. Lies, darn lies, and statistics, right?
Okay,
But basically, the thing here is that I think that what Colorado has realized And what I think it may be a canary in a coal mine, in the sense that if we see that the canary lives beyond, you know, the doomsday prophecies that are out there, then maybe it will mean something for the rest of our society. I know just in the last segment I was arguing that Everclear is an inherently dangerous substance, and I think I can still make that argument and with a straight face say that this is not something that is necessarily solely designed to get you as messed up as possible as quickly as possible, because marijuana is not necessarily that, and it affects different people in different ways. But, yeah. You know, I think part of what Colorado, the great experiment, the grand experiment that they're doing here is trying to see if, given the fact that a larger proportion of society than a lot of us are aware of do and have smoked marijuana for a long time, and that it's one of those things that becomes a great drain on our society because the law enforcement resources that are allocated towards it and all of the things that we try to do to stop people from doing something that they simply are going to keep on doing, just like prohibition.
Right.
So I think that it's ridiculous to suggest that because you can legally purchase it, we're going to have this massive increase in truancy or anything else, because we have the other laws that are there that are designed to protect society regardless of whether it's legal or illegal to possess these things. Just like an impaired driving law that they have in Colorado that exists, minors cannot buy or consume or possess it. You can't smoke it in public. They're doing it in such a way that people can do what they've done for a long time now, except they don't have to hide it.
Well, yeah, exactly. And let's be clear about the bottom line with this. People in Colorado before this law were smoking marijuana. I mean, that's like the obvious statement of the century, okay? And people all over the United States.
I've heard that people in Sheboygan are smoking marijuana.
I've heard that as well. You know. I've heard that as well. And we know that because we know that marijuana consumes a lot of the court cases all around the country. And when it comes to marijuana, if it's going to be there, isn't it better that it's regulated by the public, that it's taxed by the public, that there's, I think I heard something like over $700 million in annual revenue coming in.
That could be something that we all share.
That we all share. Right.
Now, in Colorado, if I'm not mistaken, the tax rate for an in-state resident is what, somewhere between 30% and 40%.
Oh, I don't even know.
That's what I heard on another news release on this whole thing. And this is designed to enhance the state's tax surplus, money that they have available to spend for education and for getting at the heart of the problem, because we have economic problems, we have societal problems that persist in spite of this war on drugs. Now, the war on drugs is kind of a misnomer because we obviously need to do everything we can to stop drugs that are addictive, like heroin, and drugs that are so harmful to your body and your system, and public safety, like crystal meth and cocaine and things like that, and crack cocaine and stuff like that. But when it comes to this is in a different category, scientifically, medically, and toxicologically. That was a long word.
What would you say to the devil's argument or advocate argument that that marijuana, although maybe not physiologically addictive, can be psychologically addictive?
Well, it's hard to – I think that's true. I think that it can be psychologically addictive, at least from what I've seen in cases that I've handled. But then again, soap operas are psychologically addictive. Housewives of the Beverly Hills or whatever, that's addictive, you know. And chocolate is addictive. You know, if there's something that you like, it can be psychologically addictive. If you don't like it, it's probably not going to be psychologically addictive. So this comes down to something. Do people like it or not? That's really all it is.
Kirk, one of the arguments that I know will just grind your gears, as you say, about this entire argument, as I was reading some of the articles, and we're talking about legalized marijuana in the state of Colorado for recreational use, somebody made the argument that Big Tobacco for years said that smoking cigarettes was safe. And now they're saying the same thing, big marijuana, with marijuana being safe. And, you know, the implication is, well, we'll find out in 20, 30 years.
Well, that's just plain dumb. Okay, I'll tell you two reasons why.
I told you it was going to grind your gears.
There's two reasons why that's a dumb argument. First of all, there is no big marijuana yet, okay? But if McDonald's wants to get in on the scene and start, you know, selling it, you could have like a McDoobie or whatever. And then that way, you know, maybe we will see some big marijuana out there. Or maybe, you know, Marijuana Mart or whatever, where you can go and buy, or like Sam's Club, except it would be like Cheech and Chong's Club, you know?
Oh, so
you
like,
can buy like
large quantities.
Big crates of it, yeah. You know, like how you buy 10,000 rolls of toilet paper at once. They could have the same sort of thing. But seriously, big tobacco and their efforts to get people addicted because of the nicotine and the other substances that are known to be dangerous because they are carcinogenic inhalants, that's one thing. We know, and everybody in the scientific community acknowledges that burning anything and smoking it into your lungs is not a healthy thing. It's not good for you. But if we had, there is a great deal of technology out there that allows people to inhale marijuana, vaporize marijuana, for example, without having those same carcinogenic effects. Now, I'm not saying marijuana is good for you in any sense of the word. I don't think it is. But I think it's one of those things that if somebody, we've seen that if people want to do it, they're going to.
Right.
And it's just, I think it's an interesting development. We'll see if it's
the tides are turning on it.
We'll see if it's a good development or a bad development. But I am hopeful personally that we can stop wasting community resources on tracking down marijuana
users. And I get the sense that there are a lot of police officers who actually feel the same way.
Oh,
that
yeah.
They would rather put their resources into bigger things.
Sure.
You know, rather than marijuana.
I just don't think that the presence of marijuana in a community, and it's present in every community, everywhere,
right,
throughout the whole country. There isn't a community that you can say, aha, there is no marijuana in this community. I don't think you could really say that about any community anywhere in the 50 states. But you can say that certain communities have a lower crime rate or a higher crime rate or whatever. And it may be based on a number of different factors. I keep going back to the my favorite ones, the economic and social differences that we can contribute our resources towards. You know, people are less inclined to commit crimes if they have a stable foundation, if they have a family environment that can support them morally, psychologically, physically, everything else, financially, or something equivalent to that, you know, and by having a strong society where we have support groups and we have employment opportunities and we have vocational programs and we emphasize the importance of education at an early age, not giving people an incentive to drop out of school before they've met their requirements for school, keeping programs like music, art, sports in particular. I think all those things are tremendously important for the future investment. 20 years from now, if we put enough into our school programs and we don't leave it up, that's another thing that grinds my gears is when we put a referendum out there and say, hey, do you want to spend an extra $1 million to enhance our schools? And people say, no, I don't want to do that because I don't want to pay the taxes. Well, or something like that in that voice. It turns out being something that you're depriving our future of the investment that we need to continue making.
Well, did you know that associated with Denver, there is a new position, a new job, and it is marijuana czar. There is, in fact, a marijuana czar. Now, as I said, the tide is changing on this. 66% of Denver citizens supported the retail initiative. 58%, according to the latest Gallup poll, of American adults believe that marijuana should be legal. So maybe turning, and Colorado could be right. Colorado could be the first state on recreational use in a long line of states. We'll have it yet to see. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
I'm Kirk O'Bear.
Kirk, let's talk a little bit about compassionate release. Now,
people
may
not
be familiar with what this is, but it's actually really interesting. You know, there was a lawyer, and there still is a lawyer named, or a former lawyer, she's disbarred now, named Lynn Stewart, who represented the blind sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman. And she represented him, I believe, in 1995. He was convicted because he was one of the people who helped plot to blow up landmarks in New York City, a very serious charge and conviction. He was sentenced to life in prison. Well, she went to visit him. I believe this was in the year 2000, and part of the stipulations on her visiting him was that nobody could help him communicate with the Islamic group that he was associated with because he was in prison. They didn't want him communicating in any way. Well, she went to visit him and admitted that she passed on a message in the year 2000 to the Islamic group.
Right, I remember this. Oof.
That the group should reconsider a ceasefire in attacks against the Egyptian government, okay? And we know how things recently have gone with the Egyptian government. So that ended up with Lynn Stewart being indicted, and ultimately she was convicted and initially was sentenced to something like 3.5 years, but then there was – it's a complicated thing I won't get into. But the point is she was resentenced to 10 years at that point in 2010. Now, since that time, and this was not at the time of her sentencing, I don't believe, she had become very, very ill. She had breast cancer. It had metastasized to her lungs and other areas of her body. And so she was given, at some point, less than 18 months to live. And there were some pictures of her that were released. She just looked in very ill health. The doctor in the prison where she was in Texas said she had less than 18 months. And so there's this whole procedure that's available in the federal system called compassionate release, in many states around the country as well. And basically what has to happen is the Bureau of Prisons has to, or she has to initiate this, and the Bureau of Prisons, basically the people inside the prison, have to agree, for lack of a better term, and then the judge ultimately decides if she gets compassionate release. Well, they tried to do that initially, and it was held up for some reason. And just this past week, she was granted compassionate release. Now, this isn't just, well, okay, I'm not feeling well, I'm feeling ill, I need to get out.
Yeah, you're dying.
You're dying. You're literally dying, and there's no hope for you to recover. There are also other areas for compassionate release where you can be released for things such as if you have a child that's dying or a child that's severely ill and you're the only caretaker for him or her. The interesting thing is that in the federal system, the amount of compassionate release petitions that are granted is extremely low, extremely low. And I think there was some analysis that said something like 24, and I don't remember what time period, but it was over. It was just a ridiculously low amount. Mm-hmm. She was granted this compassionate release, and she's basically going to die at home, all right? And she had already served years of her sentence, but wasn't due to be released until 2018. And so this is controversial to some people because they say, okay, you committed this crime. Whether you got cancer or not is irrelevant.
It kind of makes sense to me because let's just use a 10-year sentence as an example. A 10-year sentence isn't a life sentence. It's not a death sentence. And where you happen to die, if it's virtually for certain that you're going to die in a limited period of time, what difference does it make to our society or the integrity of the justice system or any other factor that might weigh in here where the person actually dies? Because that's not something you plan. It's not some. And my understanding of how this works is the odds of being able to fool the Department of Corrections or the Department of Justice that you're dying but you're not really dying are pretty low because these are the doctors that are on the inside that have to basically make the recommendations. So,
and it's clear from her physical symptoms. I mean, it's not something that can be faked, really.
Right.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the prosecution actually agreed with this compassionate release. And if that's true, I really give them credit because
I'll tell you why it makes sense to me. And and I do understand the argument that people out there would like to believe that when someone gets a certain sentence that they're going to serve the whole thing and that even if it means that they are in ill health, that 10-year sentence has to mean 10 years.
Well, there are people who believe that if you get cancer in prison, you shouldn't be treated for it.
I just think that's
horribly inhumane.
But here's the thing that makes the most sense to me is that when somebody's in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons and they become terminally ill, who pays for all that treatment and the medical facility and the medication and the everything else that's involved?
Oh, absolutely.
We all do. And why in the interest of making sure that someone dies within the prison system just for whatever sake that would promote, again, it doesn't promote the integrity of the justice system. It's not something that we have to guard against. I don't think anybody out would go out and commit a crime and say, hey, if I get convicted, I'll just get released on compassionate release.
Right, right. Nobody's saying that. And, you know, that's an excellent point, and you might want to isolate this audio, Kirk, because you make a very, very good point. When you talk about the actual cost to society, okay? Now, she, I believe her intention is to go to Sloan Kettering, okay, which is a top-notch hospital, a very, very good hospital, especially for cancer treatment, and she wants to go there. Now, she's going to pay for that, or at least her family's going to pay for that, and that could end up being hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, it probably will be.
Sure.
And so, you know, she gets to go home and die with some dignity, okay, rather than dying in a prison cell. Now, I think it should be, you know, I think there should be a little bit more consideration to things like that, even if it's not the actual person who's dying, but if it's their wife, for example. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan, he was sentenced to six and a half years in 2006. His wife became terminally ill with cancer, and they filed for compassionate release. The judge refused it, and really had some, I thought, sort of cold statements to make about this. I mean, you know, the guy's going to be supervised. It's not like he's not going to be supervised when he's out.
Well, let me ask you this. What happens if the person recovers from their supposedly terminal condition? I don't know if that's ever happened, but what do we as a society do about that?
Well,
do we put the person back in prison at that point?
I guess. I mean, I don't think that's ever happened, but I think there are, and you may know this, I think there are temporary furloughs that can be granted
sure.
as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's a situation. But, you know, if it's a situation where it's metastasized to this level.
The other thing that a lot of people may not realize, especially about the federal system, is that as a person progresses into their sentence, they are in a lower and lower security type setting and end up usually in a minimum security facility where they're working at a job, living in an apartment, and basically just reporting in about their whereabouts. And
right.
it's really just like not being in prison. And that can be a significant portion of a sentence that isn't, a life sentence or something like that.
Yeah. Well, this is now happened, and I think it's brought some. Now, did what Lynn Stewart did, was that right? Of course not. It was a bad thing to
what
do.
What about this? What if it was the blind sheikh that was, terminally ill and was asking for a compassionate release? How would we feel about that?
They consider the nature of the crime, too.
Sure.
And they consider whether a person is remorseful or not. And I think that, I believe he's made it clear that he's not all that remorseful.
Not all that remorseful.
Yeah, maybe that's a
maybe
soft
not
way
remorseful
of saying
at all.
It. And it was a very serious crime. Now, so was Lynn Stewart's, but it was not nearly as serious as plotting to blow up buildings in the United States. So there's a whole list of factors. It's not just anybody who's terminally ill is going to be released. That, in fact, that almost never happens.
Well, let me point this out also for those that might wonder if this is a good idea. But this is something that is incorporated into our penal system, and it's somebody didn't just imagine this. I mean, this had to be. There's appropriations that for people have to make these types of decisions. It's part of the operating procedures, if you will, of the Department of Justice, and it's not like it was just some random thought. So, like many things, we talk all the time about how we have mechanisms within the system that have to deal with a variety of circumstances. You can't have a one-size-fits-all type justice system, because if you do, you're going to have those situations where somebody doesn't fit into the mold that was made, much like mandatory
right.
minimum sentences for different types of cases. But we've been talking about how executive clemency is another factor that's built into the system. It's built into the law. It's been made part of the structure that we deal with. And when you just ignore one of those pieces of the puzzle and have it eliminated, then it doesn't function the way it's supposed to, and you can't accommodate for the variety of circumstances that are presented by each individual case.
And part of this is, this really is justice. I mean, do we want to live in a society where we are to that level that if somebody literally is wasting away and they're dying a horrible death of cancer, now someone would say, well, they deserve it. They're in prison. I think that's an unfortunate.
Well, when it's the Bureau of Prisons that's making the recommendation for the person to be, they're in charge of correcting the person, okay?
Right.
And when it's determined that the person's life is at such a point where you know, go home and die, it's not really
well, and
that
judges,
much of a gift
judges
to give
do
anybody.
Make, d- judges often take into consideration, and I would argue in every case they do this, a person's age and how far along they progress. So if you're 40 years old and you go into prison and suddenly you get cancer, and you're sentenced for some type of, let's say, theft, you know, let's say it's a major theft and you're sentenced to 5 years in prison, but yet you get cancer and you're given, you know, virtually no chance to live beyond the next 12 months. Well, should you be released? I would argue yes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a really sad thing. But we do have more to talk about on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk, you will enjoy this story because it's somewhat humorous, although serious at the same time. Tampa, Florida, last Sunday evening, according to news accounts, police arrested 24-year-old Jonathan Charles Stevens after they say that he hit the red and blue flashing lights in Chevrolet Tahoe to stop a Tampa officer to report a reckless driver. Stevens told the female officer that he was a Homeland Security officer and wanted to report a reckless driver. He wore a badge around his neck and let her know that he was carrying a Glock 45 caliber handgun. He also reportedly called dispatch to report the same reckless driver prior to pulling over the officer. Stevens was charged with impersonating a police officer, unlawful use of blue lights, and carrying a concealed firearm. He was released Monday morning after posting $17,500 bail. The incident marks the second time in 3 months that Stevens has been charged with impersonating a police officer. September 7th, he was also sitting in an undercover vehicle. He heard wailing sirens followed by flashing lights. This officer was sitting in his vehicle. And the officer then witnessed Stevens pull over a woman in the parking lot of an outlet mall. After a brief exchange, the woman drove off and the driver of the Tahoe headed into a coffee shop, allowing the officers time to run the plates. After discovering the Tahoe was not registered to a law enforcement agency, they contacted the woman, who said the man who pulled her over said he was an off-duty police officer. So I think he very badly wants to be a real police officer, but he's
well, maybe he's just practicing and thinking about throwing that on his resume when he applies to the police department. He goes, I've been doing my homework, and I've actually been playing the role of a police officer in society, and I can show you how good I've been. I've been pulling people over, including other police officers.
Yes, and that would be a bad idea, just in case anybody would think about it.
And if you're going to do that, don't tell them that you've got your Glock on you. Exactly. It's probably a bad idea.
Probably a bad idea as well. Just don't do that overall.
Well, yeah, just don't do any of that.
Wisconsin has an underage drinking bill that just became law. The governor has signed a bill that's aimed at curbing underage drinking. According to the Associated Press, this is the so-called Brown Jug Bill, named after an Alaskan bar that got a bill passed, essentially, which is a similar one. It creates an additional one.
Wait, let me guess. Was it called the Brown Jug?
I think it was probably called the Brown Jug.
Okay.
So if you're ever there, you could try to go there. I'm sure it's wonderful. It creates an additional $1,000 fine for those under 21 who buy or drink alcohol. Okay, an extra $1,000. And it gives, this is interesting, it gives bar owners, these establishments, the right to sue the underage patrons who attempt to get into their bar and purchase alcohol.
Okay, this is not aimed at underage patrons, by the way. It's aimed at their parents.
Right, exactly.
That's right,
because we know that these underage folks, for the most part, do not have the resources to pay the extra
$1,000. Mom and dad pay the fine.
Yeah, mom and dad pay it. On top of the, you know, $250 to $1,000 fine for underage drinking, this is an extra $1,000 that they could be sued for by the bar. Now, imagine how popular some of these establishments on college campuses will be when they start taking these kids
to court.
These kids, 18, 19, 20
year old. Underage people
to court and suing them. And the idea, I guess, behind this is just to make sure that they can cover the cost of liability. I don't even know. I don't even understand exactly because they're already fined. And they're already cited for underage drinking. We already have a law that covers that.
Yeah.
But now you have an extra $1,000 per patron potentially.
Yeah. I think this provision where it gives the tavern owners the ability to sue the individual and presumably their parents or family or whatever the case may be is an interesting one only in the sense that it's really misdirecting the fault, isn't it? And you're right. There is already liability that the bar owner faces. So think about this conundrum that you might be in. You know, you simultaneously may be in a position where you could sue somebody for fooling you that you were of age, but you also at the same time have a legal responsibility to not serve that person, and you can't hide behind the fact that they give you a fake ID, for example. So,
right.
So where does that niche fit where you've been diligent in trying to make sure that the person isn't underage, yet at the same time, if you fail in that duty and serve the person and then they get in trouble for it, then you can also sue them because you got in trouble
right,
by
exactly.
serving them.
Exactly.
It's like a triangle.
It is like a triangle. And, you know, I guess the money comes out of the parents' pocket, as you point out in the end. Well, a similar trio of drunk driving bills that we've talked about before, there was one that they want to make everybody who has a first offense drunk driving show up in court for every appearance and not be able to have an appearance on behalf of the lawyer. And then the other ones that are basically increasing the penalties. There was one proposal, I think, to make third offense OWI a felony and other such things, increase the basically provisions regulating ignition interlock devices in people's cars. Well, the bills are apparently going nowhere in the state Senate. They passed in the state assembly but are going nowhere. And Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald told the Associated Press this past weekend that he would prefer to spend money on setting up special drunk driving treatment courts statewide before considering the bills. And you know what? Kudos and bravo to him for saying that. Because as you and I have talked about many times, and as we talked about in this show, simply just increasing the penalties often does nothing in terms of preventing somebody from driving drunk. And if you actually have special drunk driving treatment courts, much like in Sheboygan, we have a wonderful program, the Veterans Court program, which is basically overseen by Judge Sakevich. It's a great program. It does, you know, wonders for veterans. Similarly, I think drunk driving treatment courts would do similar things for people who are struggling with alcoholism.
I would agree with you if we do it the right way, because I know that there are counties that have had experiments with these types of treatment courts. Dane County is one, for example. And the problem is that it can be viewed and it can be utilized by the prosecution as a means to get somebody to waive all of their rights that might although drunk driving is not a good thing, no one can argue that, by having a forum whereby a person can keep the law healthy, I guess that's
right.
The best way to put it, by making sure that challenges are there and that when there isn't probable cause, that issue can be raised and that someone's not intimidated into waiving all of their rights in order to get into treatment court. Overall, I think it's a great idea because I think that it does get to the root of the problem. But I've seen problems in various counties where, let's say somebody has a case where, I'll just give you a scenario that's entirely possible. And in fact, I've seen cases like this where somebody simply wasn't driving, but the officer mistakenly believed the person was because of the circumstances. Officer knocks on the door after hearing a complaint of reckless driving and traces the vehicle back to the person's house and it's parked in the driveway. Guy answers the door and he's drunk. And the cop says, well, you know, what were you doing tonight? Well, I was driving earlier. Well, how long have you been home? A while. Were you drinking then? And, you know, sometimes there can be a little confusion about what's going on. And sometimes an officer may be acting on what he perceives rather than what he hears
right.
or sees, or he or she hears or sees. And that person can then be placed under arrest and charged with an OWI. So then they get put into the situation where, and again, I think drug courts and treatment courts are a good thing generally, but there are these scenarios where somebody ends up saying, in order to get the opportunity to avoid, you know, the possibility of severe consequences, they have to basically end up admitting that they were driving when they weren't. Right. And that becomes a problem in our society. And it's not just limited to these drunk driving types of cases, because didn't we just talk about this a few weeks ago on the radio with, in terms of how the federal system has been inundated with cases that are because of co-conspirators that are charged, or because of the fact that plea agreements are reached where there's one person snitching against another or getting credit for their assistance and so on, that the system has become one in which nobody takes anything to trial anymore and nobody challenges anything anymore. And we've become, especially in the federal world, a society of people that plead guilty to whatever they're charged with. And the prosecutor holds the key to that. So we've seen that in the federal system work in such a way that I think it's bad for justice. I think treatment's essential. I think treatment's necessary. But I don't think it should be the kind of thing where somebody as a result of their participating in these treatment programs,
waives all their rights.
We don't need that. We really don't need that.
No, we don't.
But you know, that's always there. It's always something that they place at a premium, is that if you're going to have a chance at treatment, we're going to make you waive everything. And if you mess up on treatment, boom, you're convicted. On the other hand, we could do it in such a way that the prosecution is merely suspended for a period of time, give somebody a chance to participate. But there is no mechanism currently under Wisconsin law where it would have the benefit of allowing a person to avoid an actual conviction. So even in these treatment courts, the effect is that it can reduce the amount of jail, and that's essentially all it does, is it makes it so somebody who would otherwise serve 6 months serves 4 months. So,
well, I just think we need to get rid of this stigma in society that says that treatment is somehow a leniency, or allowing for these types of courts is somehow a leniency. You know, what it really does is it gets at the underlying issues of the problem. It's not meant just to be, you know, some lenient thing. It really isn't. It's meant to be an opportunity for the person to prove themselves during the pendency of the case. And if they can prove themselves, then we as a society benefit, not only because they've successfully completed treatment or whatever the case may be, but also because we spend less money on incarcerating persons who are in those situations. And, you know, veterans are a wonderful example of people who deserve a second chance, if not many others. And I think that people who struggle with alcoholism and other such diseases also, in many cases, in some cases, deserve that second chance. So that's about it for today's show. You've been listening to another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.